do not mean to pry, but you don't by any chance happen to have six fingers on your right hand?
Do you always begin conversations this way?
My father was slaughtered by a six-fingered man. Was a great swordmaker, my father. When the six-fingered man appeared and requested a special sword, my father took the job. He slept a year before he was done.
I've never seen its equal.
Six-fingered man returned and demanded it, but at one-tenth his promised price. My father refused. Without a word, the six-fingered man slashed him through the heart. I love my father, so naturally I challenged his murderer to a duel. I failed. Six-fingered man left me alive, but he gave me this.
How old were you?
I was 11 years old. When I was strong enough, I dedicated my life to the study of fencing. So the next time we meet, I will not fail. I will go up to the six-fingered man and say, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die."
You've done nothing but study swordplay.
More pursuit than a study later. You see, I can't find him. It's been 20 years now, and I'm starting to lose confidence. I just go for a facade to pay the bills. It's not a lot of money in revenge.
Since McCluskey's killing, the police have been cracking down most of our operations, and also the other families. Been a lot of bad blood. They hit us, so we hit them back.
You said you wanted to know how to get to Capone. You really want to get him. You see what I'm saying? What are you prepared to do?
Everything that's in the law.
And then what are you prepared to do? If you open the ball on these people, Mr. Mass, you must be prepared to go all the way. Because they won't give up the fight until one of you is dead.
I'm going to get Capone. I don't know how to get him.
You want to get Capone? Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue.
Kill the Dark One and the Giant, but leave the third for questioning.
Hello. My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Revenge! It's Kick-a-Kick-Ken! Kick-a-coming to Kick-a-Kick kill me! How are you gonna Kick-a-Kick-catch me, Kick-a-Kick-Ken?
Now, where was I?
You and me, what do you say? Okay. 60-40. That's my final offer.
Revenge!
Wait, I got an idea. You take it all. Yeah, here's my boarding pass. Ken!
I'm gonna kill you.
Wait, okay, fine, Ken. Come at me. Give me your best shot. Go on, Ken. You don't have the guts. Admit it. Okay, you have the guts. Good. Wait. All right, I'm sorry. I hate it.
I tried.
You must be that little Spanish brat I taught a lesson to all those years ago. Simply incredible. Have you been chasing your whole life only to fail now? I think that's the worst thing I've ever heard.
Well, that's just an example of how ingrained the idea of revenge is in our culture. And I imagine that you can think of a whole bunch of other examples, maybe even from your own life, of how sweet revenge can taste. Well, you know, it's not just we who have something to say about revenge. Jesus also had something to say about that. And unlike his contemporary that we read the quote from a while back, he meant this teaching for both men and women. And so what I want to do is take a look at Matthew chapter 5 and see what Jesus has to say about this subject of revenge. Back before we started the 40 Days of Purpose, we were studying the teachings of Jesus in Matthew chapter 5 through 7. That's also called the Sermon on the Mount. And it's part of what we're calling the Jesus curriculum, the things that Jesus wanted to teach us, his followers. First of all, Jesus talked about the character of the people who would be in God's kingdom. And then he talked about the code of the kingdom, and that's what we've been dealing with lately, the way that Jesus wants his followers to be, to behave, to act. And he tells us that our righteousness has to be genuine. In other words, not just external actions, but also internal attitudes. In Jesus' day, there was a group of people called the Pharisees who were very careful about what their behavior looked like and that all the things that they did appeared very righteous and devout and holy. Jesus called them hypocrites. It's the word for actors. It meant that they were playing a role because on the outside, they were different than they were on the inside. On the outside, they conformed themselves to the letter of God's law. But on the inside, their attitudes were wicked and evil and selfish. And that's true so often in our own lives, where even if we have the gumption to try to clean up our lives and do the right thing, it's more than that that Jesus wants. He wants both our external actions and our internal attitudes to match his character. For example, first of all, we saw that murder is wrong, and everybody agrees that that's the case, even the Pharisees, that's obvious. But murder is just an external attitude that's often motivated by the internal heart attitude. And so Jesus says that it's also wrong to harbor unresolved anger in your heart, whether or not it leads to murder. And then also we all agree probably that it's wrong to commit adultery, that that's wrong. And yet Jesus says that it's also wrong to nurture sexual desire in your heart for somebody other than your spouse. Third, we saw that God permits divorce, because when a marriage has failed, it's wrong to just abandon your spouse and leave them unable to remarry. And so God instituted divorce as an escape hatch from a marriage that was failed. But Jesus says that doesn't mean, though, that it's right to get divorced for any reason. And he says that capriciously to divorce your spouse just because you're tired of being married to him or her and want to be married to somebody else, that that's wrong. And then lastly, we saw that we'd all agree maybe that it's wrong to break your oath, to go back on your word, but Jesus said that the real point is to be a truthful person, that inside and out we are truthful. And so those are the four things we've looked at already in the code, and that brings us today to verse 38, where he turns to the issue of revenge. And the next few verses talk about justice and revenge. You know, God has given us some real legitimate avenues for justice here on earth. And I think we all have inside us this thirst for justice. We want things, when we're really little, we want things to be fair, right? You know, it's not fair that Johnny got two candy bars and I got one. And we want fairness and justice for all. And so that's just kind of the way we're built. And God has given us some avenues for that justice to take place. But one of them is not personal revenge. And Jesus warns us that although that is a way we often try to get justice, that it is completely out of bounds and something different than God's justice. Revenge might taste sweet, but it's wrong. Just as John Milton said in Paradise Lost, revenge at first though sweet, bitter ere long back on itself recoils. And he recognized that there was a cost to revenge, just like there's a cost to all sin. Our passage today is a very confusing one, and it's often been misunderstood in several different ways. And it has led to all kinds of foggy, fuzzy thinking about Jesus and what kind of a person he was and what he taught. This passage is also one from which we get four well-known sayings that almost everybody in this room has used at one time or another, and if not used it, you've surely heard these. And here are the four phrases that are common in our culture. Almost everybody, if you walk down the street, would know them, and they come, all four of them, from this passage. An eye for an eye, turn the other cheek, go the second mile, and give him the shirt off your back. All four of those things come from this passage. So let's open our Bibles, or you can read along with me up on the screen if you want to, and we're going to see what Jesus teaches about revenge in Matthew 5:38. It starts off this way. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. And if you remember from our study back before we began the 40 days, every section in this passage, in this section about the kingdom code is like this. He starts off by saying, here's what you've heard. This is what they've taught, what you've read in the Old Testament. This is what you know. And I want to tweak this a little bit for you. I want to remind you, not just about the externals, but about the internals. So he's doing the same thing here. You've heard that it was said, meaning back in the Old Testament, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. That phrase occurs three different times in the Old Testament, and it's always in the context of a series of laws where it says, if somebody does something wrong, they need to be punished, you want to make sure that the punishment fits the crime. And so, actually, in the Old Testament, you know, this sounds a little bit harsh to us, and we also have gotten used to kind of expecting that the Old Testament is kind of a much harsher, less grace-oriented time. But actually, this was a measure of grace and justice, and it was something that God gave to the people of Israel so that they wouldn't take more vengeance than was appropriate. You know, when something happens to us, we rarely want to pay somebody back with just what happened, you know, what they did to us. We want to pay them back and then give them a little bonus. You know, it's kind of like playing poker where, you know, you're sitting down and somebody goes, well, I give you an insult. And then you say, well, okay, I see your insult and I raise you a poke in the eye. You know, and so, you know, the thing goes back and forth like that until pretty soon they're at each other's throats and we're just not settled with getting even, whatever that phrase means. You know, we have this kind of concept in our mind that here's these two little charts we're keeping and he's done something to me. Oh man, I owe him. I need to get even so that I'm up here. And, you know, we overshoot the mark. And so now this guy has to get even, you know, and it just keeps going up and up. And so this is kind of the way that we're built. And people have been built this way for a long, long time. And so it wasn't uncommon and still is not today for people to get involved in vendettas because of the kinds of things that they've experienced and they've suffered. Julie and I, as you know, were missionaries in Yugoslavia for 4 years. And in Yugoslavia, this is a really big thing. And you can tell just by reading the newspapers back here in the early 90s, as you saw the Yugoslav war unfold, here's what would happen is somebody, let's say a Serb, predominantly Orthodox in Serbia, let's say that one of their relatives who was a Serb living in Bosnia was killed by Muslims. And so they would say, well, we have to get even. Now, it might have been a car accident or anything else, but we got to get even. So what they'd go do is, it's not enough to just kill the Muslim who actually did this. You have to kill two or three Muslims to make up for that. And it doesn't really matter if it's the same people that were involved in the accident or not, as long as it's any of them. So they go kill three. Well, the families of each of those three people who are killed are going to want revenge too. And they're going to want three Serbs killed. And the thing just escalates and escalates. And we saw that happen as the country just kind of came unglued. Well, this is the way people have been for a long time. And so when God gave Moses the law, he said, there needs to be a limit on justice. In other words, if somebody causes somebody else to lose an eye, then you don't kill him. Rather, it's the eye that he owes. Now, I think it's pretty rare that they'd actually poke the guy's eye out, but what they do is figure out what an eye cost, and that's what that man would have to pay in reparations to the person that he wounded. And so that's the idea that comes from this verse, is it's measured justice, appropriate justice. The word that is in between here is anti-eye. In other words, it means that an eye instead of an eye to replace an eye. It's the same word that gets used of Jesus where it says that he died in our place. He died for us. And that's the same word here. So the idea is replacing what you took away. Now, this wasn't meant to restrain, this was meant to restrain revenge, to make sure that the punishment didn't exceed the crime. And there was room for grace, and there was also, this kept people from going too far in their punishments. You know, when somebody hurts us, our natural tendency is payback. That's what we want, is payback. And so we want them to hurt like we are hurting, like they hurt us. We talk about getting even, we talk about settling the score, and the idea is that somehow if we hurt them in return, then things are going to be even. And you know, that's what we owe them, and it's a debt that we're only too happy to pay. In fact, usually we want to, you know, raise the stakes there. Well, this was designed to try to keep that from happening, and so the Bible gives us measured justice in the Old Testament. And this is what Jesus reminds them of. You've heard of measured justice, right? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. He's not condemning this. He's saying, you've heard this, and that's exactly right. That's the external code that God has put out. But you know what? Even if we stay within the bounds of inflicting reciprocal pain, you know, the same thing that we suffered that we give out, we're still missing the point. Because our external conformity to the demands of justice is often masking this internal problem that we have. We want revenge. And the Bible says that revenge is sin. And Jesus says this, that's why he continues on here. You've heard an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, but I tell you, do not resist an evil person. So when we're hurt, that's what we want, payback. But Jesus says, no, don't fight back. He said, the word resist here is kind of an interesting one, and I'm not sure that maybe that's the best translation for it. It's part of what creates the confusion about this verse. But this word, resist, means to oppose someone, to set yourself against someone. It's actually a compound word that literally means to stand anti, to stand opposite somebody or against somebody, you know, anti means the opposite, and so that's what this word is, to stand opposite that, to be hostile towards somebody. And I think the idea here is not so much about non-resistance. I don't think it's a verse about non-resistance. I think it's about not facing off. It's about not raising the stakes and making this a you versus me kind of competition with this person that has hurt you. Now, I don't think this verse is teaching pacifism. Sometimes people have used this verse to say, see, we should just not resist evil, and nations should not resist evil either, and certainly churches shouldn't, and so we should all be Switzerland and let whatever happens, happens, and that's what we're going to do. I don't think that's what this verse is teaching at all, but it's clearly not teaching aggression either. In the Bible, there's plenty of room for self-defense. You know, there's lots of other verses that would support that and examples of that. But this verse is a specific warning not to take personal retribution, not to go out and get personal revenge for the things that have happened to you. It's basically saying, don't escalate this situation by trying to get even, because that's just going to bump this up higher and higher. But rather, de-escalate it, pull it down, diffuse it, lower the stakes, pacify the other person's anger, endure through this, forgive the other person and the things that they've done. You know, this is a completely unnatural response. And like many of the things that we've seen in Jesus' teaching, this just goes counter to our instincts. And so it is just so different than the way that we think. For example, listen to Nikita Khrushchev, who said, we had no use for the policies of the Gospels. If someone slaps you, just turn the other cheek. We had shown that anyone who slapped us on our cheek would get his head kicked off. Okay? Now, I don't know about you, but most days that's the way I wake up too. You know, it's like I just, you know, mess with me, kick their head off. And so this is what Khrushchev said, and this is kind of the way that we feel about it. But Jesus calls us to act counterintuitively, and instead of meeting evil with evil or with a greater force of evil, what he does is urges us to meet evil with a completely different kind of force, a completely different weapon than the weapon that was used against us. And so he urges us to use good in response to evil. instead of paying back in kind, we're called to pay back with kindness. And boy, is that counter to the way that we think and the way that we feel. There's a parallel passage in Romans 12 that explains how this works, and I want to look at that this morning too. It starts off this way: don't repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody. And if it's possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Now, what he's saying here is don't do evil just because somebody did evil to you. That's repaying evil for evil. So just because somebody hurt you and did something not nice to you or really nasty to you, doesn't mean that you need to go and do it back. They did the wrong thing, but you do the right thing. Now, I'd really like to know, does this sound suspiciously like something mom used to tell you, or suspiciously like something that you just said to your kids yesterday? You know, I think, at least at our house, it always is like that. It's like the younger one hits the older one. I'm not going to use any names, and I'm just making up genders here, okay? So that way I won't owe anybody any money. But the younger one hits the older one, and so the older one hits him back. So the younger one runs and finds mom and dad and says, "Mom, Jimmy hit me." And mom says, "Jimmy, did you hit your little sister?" "Yeah." "Well, why would you do such a thing?" "Well, because she hit me first." And, you know, you want so badly for them to get it. And you want to say, look, I'll take care of you. I'll take care of that. You take care of you. And trust me, you have your hands full taking care of you. You're going to be a lot of work for you. So if you can just keep yourself in line, that'd be great, and I'll take care of your little sister. I'll take care of making sure that she does the right thing, and you take care of making sure that you do the right thing. You know, I think that that's exactly what God is saying to us in these verses and trying to get us to do with each other, just like we're trying to get our kids to do it, just like our parents tried to get us to do with our brothers and sisters. And he says, don't get involved in the business of trying to get even, trying to make sure that everybody gets what they deserve. That's God's job. And you know what? He's really good at it. He does a great job at that. And so we don't need to worry about it. In fact, we've got another job. We're supposed to try to get along with each other as much as possible. I love the clarity of this verse and the realistic nature of it, you know? Look at the end of this verse. If it's possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Don't you love that it didn't just say, live at peace with everyone, go do it, you know? It says, if it's possible, in other words, it might not be, it takes two to live at peace, and the other person, the other party might not be willing. And as far as it depends on you, recognizing that there's a lot on the other side maybe, and it may only depend on you. And so if it's possible, and as well as you can, try to live at peace with everyone. If we do that, there's one problem, and you probably thought of it already, and that's that nobody stops the aggressor. Nobody keeps Jimmy from hitting his sister. You know, nobody keeps somebody from saying ugly things to us or doing whatever it is they're going to do, rip us off. If we don't give him what he deserves, then he's just going to keep on doing it, and then pretty soon somebody else is going to get hurt. And next time, he's going to keep going, and next time what's going to happen? Nothing, and so he'll just keep going and going and going. And where is justice? Where's the justice in that? That's not fair, that's not right, and it's not good for us. You know what? God has an answer for us about that. And here's what he says in the next verse, verse 19. Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge. I will repay, says the Lord. See, what he's really doing is saying when we jump in and we start to take revenge, personal retribution for our wrongs, the things that how we've been hurt, how we've been mistreated, and we step in and try to make things right, you know what? We're getting in God's way because that's God's job, and he's going to take care of that. And we're actually inserting ourselves in front and getting in the path of what God is trying to do in that situation, trying to do God's job. It's like, you know, this is a silly illustration talking about God, but it's kind of like playing volleyball, you know, and it's like mine, you know, and then you run into each other because you didn't listen, and God, you know, when the revenge ball comes over the net, God's going, mine. It sounds a little more, you know, mine. So our job is to get out of the way and let God do his job. God is going to take care of justice. And you know what? It might not be when we want it to happen. It might not be how we want it to happen. Sometimes God's justice has a nasty way of leaving us very dissatisfied. But it's only because we're so impatient, because we want it now and we want it our way. And God has a way that he's going to do all of this, and he's going to take care of this in his own time and in his own way. He will make sure that justice is done. Now, this policy that Jesus has here of not resisting or standing against, not opposing an evil person and what they do, not fighting with that evil person, this policy is not a lack of justice. Rather, it's a call to not take personal revenge in order to get justice. Leave justice and revenge to God. Some of the justice that awaits us, we're not going to see until we get to heaven. Some of God's justice, he's not going to implement until life is over for all of us and we're all in heaven. But some of God's justice is going to happen here on earth, and it happens in a lot of different ways. In fact, there's one particular way that God tells us that he exercises justice on this earth. He has certain agents that he uses for that justice and for that very purpose, justice agents. And you know, it's not you and it's not me. It's the French. It's the French government, and it's the American government, and it's the Iraqi government, and it's the South African government. Because the Bible says that God uses government to bring a measure of justice to this world. They are his agents. It isn't perfect justice. It doesn't always work, and it isn't enough. It's hardly ever enough. And there are some countries that have better justice than others, but those are the agents that God uses to bring justice, and that's part of the plan of how he brings justice on the planet. While we're waiting for the perfect justice of his kingdom, the governments of the world at least hold back evil. They restrain it, and they bring some of that notion, some modicum of justice to our world. They are God's instruments, his justice agents. Just a couple verses later in Romans 13:4, Paul says, government is God's servant to do you good. That's how God intends government to be, and it doesn't always get it right, but government is God's servant to do you good, all governments. If you do what's wrong, though, be afraid, for he, the government, does not bear the sword for nothing. He's God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. The idea here where it says that the government doesn't bear the sword for nothing, that phrase bearing the sword refers to the government's ability to kill people. It means execution or waging war. And it says, you know, God has delegated this responsibility to the governments of the world and their leaders to be able to have that ability to wage war and to execute criminals. And the idea is that they're supposed to use it to bring justice to the world. Now, they don't always, but you know what? They have to answer for that, not me. So I let them answer to that before God, because they will. That's God's business to take care of. But a legitimate biblical function of government is to punish those who do wrong. And when they do, then the government functions as God's agents to punish evil. That's part of how God administers justice. And so it's not perfect, but one day God is going to fix all that as well, and there will be perfect justice. And in the meantime, what we're supposed to do is keep out of the way and let God do his thing. And we've got a different job to do. And I know you're all ready to hear what that is, right? It's in the very, back in chapter 12, as we continue, he says, here's our job. Do not take revenge, as we said before. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. And in doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. We are supposed to answer evil with good. You know, in Matthew, when Jesus says it, he just simply says, don't oppose, don't be hostile toward this evil person. But here in Romans, it spells it out a little further, and it explains what it means to not be opposed, and it says what that means is instead you should be doing good. Instead of doing evil, which would be vengeful, do good to that person. The trap is that we might be overcome by evil, that we might be so hurt and so wounded that we choose an evil path in order to try to settle the score and make things even. And that's the temptation. And God says, try paying back instead evil with good. Try seeing what happens. In fact, that's even more devastating to the person that has hurt you if you pay it back with good. It's like heaping burning coals on their head. You know, everybody understands tit for tat. They all understand that. Everybody out there understands you get what you deserve and you get payback. That's the way the world works. And they have a really, really hard time with paying back evil with good. They don't understand it. It doesn't compute. You know, we don't understand it. It just doesn't fit with the way that we think. And it makes people's consciences burn. Burns because they cannot, it drives them to rethink what they're doing, their approach, because they're not getting the result that they anticipated and expected. And so it forces them to go back and rethink why they're doing evil, because it didn't result in what they thought they were going to get. And they're dumbfounded, and their consciences burn and hurt them. And that's what this verse says, is if you repay good for evil, then it drives people nuts, because they're trying to figure out what's going on. And so that's the way to overcome evil. You know, you want to overcome evil in our society, in our country, in your neighborhood. You know how you overcome evil? This verse says it's not by fighting against it. It's not by punishing it. It's not by trying to stamp it out. It's not by condemning it loudly and with lots of names. It's by smothering it with kindness and generosity until it can no longer breathe, until there's no air left for it to pull from and draw from. I want to go back to our passage in Matthew, because this idea that we've been talking about of here's something that's hurt us and we desire in our hearts to get even and have revenge for it, and God says instead, what I want you to do is try repaying good for that instead of repaying it with evil. Try doing good in the face of that. And what we're going to see as we go back to the passage in Matthew is Jesus gives us four examples of exactly that. And so these four examples, this principle of answering evil with kindness and generosity, have to do with physical assault, with unfair lawsuits, with compulsory service, and with exploited generosity. And so let's look at those four. Here's the first one in verse 39. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Boy, haven't you all heard that verse before? Here it is. So we're going to talk about what that means. In Jesus' day, getting struck on the right cheek probably meant a slap across the face with the back of the hand, because a right-handed person... Mark, you want to come up? Let me demonstrate on you here, okay? Okay, you don't need to. But, you know, if I went back and whacked you with my right hand on your right cheek, that would be with the back of my hand. That was the worst insult that you could give somebody in Jewish culture. And so in addition to probably being fairly painful, it was a horrible insult. And it still is today in the Middle East, a terrible insult to do that to somebody. Now, this verse says, if that happens to you, turn to him the other cheek also, the other cheek. I don't think that this verse means do not defend yourself. I think some people read this and they kind of go, well, so I'm just supposed to stand there and take it. I don't think that it means don't defend yourself. I think what it means is it doesn't mean to ask for another hit. You know, yes, sir, may I have another? Doesn't mean that. I think that we have great examples of both Jesus and Paul who actually were literally, this happened to them, and it's recorded in the Bible, where Jesus and Paul, each at different occasions, were struck in the face, slapped in the face by soldiers that had them in custody. And do you know what both of them did? Both of them appealed to their rights. Both of them argued that it was unlawful for them to strike a prisoner who was innocent. And so I think that there's plenty of examples in the Bible and call for self-defense, but here's what they didn't do. They didn't hit back. They didn't return the blow for another blow. And I think that's the force of this verse. If you are struck, if you are insulted, don't fight back. Don't retaliate. Don't try to get even. Let it go. In other words, forgive it. It doesn't mean, you know, okay, give me another one. I want another one over here so that I'll feel balanced. It means let it go. Forgive it. And so when you're offering your other cheek, I think what you're doing is you're demonstrating that our relationship is just like it was before you did that to me. I'm not holding anything against you. I'm still risking this relationship. I'm still here. My faith, I'm still right there. My face is right before you. I think that's the force of what this verse is saying, that it's better to receive a second blow because you've done that than it is to stoop to the same level as the person who attacked you and to fight back. That's what it means to turn the other cheek. It means don't try to get even. In other words, it means to be kind and generous even when somebody verbally or physically assaults your person. So even if they're attacking you, it means that you're still kind and you're still generous. Their out-of-bounds attack doesn't affect the way that you treat them, because that's not the way you respond. You don't respond tit for tat. You respond by doing the right thing, because that's what God's called you to do, instead of doing the thing that feels like justice and revenge. The good news is, you know, you don't have to wait for violence to put this principle into practice. You know, if you are going, well, I'd really like to apply this verse, but nobody's struck me in a long time. It's okay. You can use it in other ways. Have you ever met somebody at church or school or at work, and they just were not nice to you? You know, they just were unkind in the things that they said. They were uncaring and insensitive, and they might as well have just told you that they didn't like you and that you could leave. Has that happened to anybody here today? I mean, you know, in your lifetime? Maybe it wasn't anything that you did, or maybe it was. It doesn't really matter. They just weren't particularly friendly to you or weren't very nice. Well, how did you respond to that? How do you respond if somebody just doesn't treat you very nicely? If they're not very friendly, you meet them for the first time and they're not friendly, they don't smile, they don't respond. I'll tell you what we'd all like to do. What we'd all like to do is say, well, fine, two can play at that game. You know, if they're not going to be nice to me, I'm not going to be nice to them. In fact, I'll show them how unnice I can be, you know. And we kind of do the up the ante thing, and you know, I see your unfriendliness, and I raise you some nasty comments, you know, and a little gossip on the side. So, you know, we that's what we'd like to do. And we'd like to say, I'm going to be unfriendly right back. But turning the other cheek means answering that snub with kindness and with generosity. It means being friendly to them, even though they were unfriendly to you. Now, this is not some masochistic desire to be snubbed again, you know, like, please hit my other cheek. But it's showing your face, showing that there's been no offense because you've already forgiven them, and you are leaving the issue of justice and fairness to God. The second example is in the next verse, verse 40. And it says, okay, Jesus says, here's another one. If somebody wants to sue you and take your tunic, well, let him have your cloak as well. Now, the tunic was a shirt that was worn next to the body. It was like the inside clothes, not an undershirt, but like your regular shirt. And on top of that, in Jesus' day, you wore a cloak, which was almost like a blanket. And so even if you lost your shirt, you know, which is maybe another phrase that comes from here, I don't know, but if you lost your shirt, then you still had that blanket to keep you warm. And in fact, the law protected that outer garment, that cloak, from lawsuits. You could not sue somebody and take away their coat. Now, in our day, you might sue somebody's pants off, but you cannot, in Jesus' day, sue off their cloak. This just doesn't work. And they didn't wear pants, and so that's why they had this law, I'm sure. So anyway, the Jewish law permitted somebody to sue and get your shirt. They could take the shirt off your back, but they couldn't take your cloak. It was protected, and it was yours. Now, the lawsuit in this verse might be a legitimate case. Maybe this person actually violated the rights of the other person or something, and they deserve the lawsuit. Who knows? But you know what? I can't help but think that because there's kind of an undercurrent in this passage that suggests that this might be an unfair settlement. And that current that runs through here is this idea that all these things are ways that people have wronged me, and you kind of get the idea that here in a lawsuit, it might be an unjust lawsuit. And so even if it's unfair, even if this isn't the right verdict, once again, The idea is not that you be some Christian wimp and that you get, if you get unjustly sued, then you shouldn't put on a defense, or you should automatically just give the plaintiff whatever he's asking for and more. The idea is rather that we shouldn't try to get even. And so what it's saying is don't just try to get even by countersuing and see if you can take his shirt too. And don't just do it in order to get back at them and do something to make them really pay for what they did. But instead, be generous with what you own. Hold your possessions loosely, so loosely that you're willing to give them up. If that's the only way to hang on, if the only way to hang on to them is to fight for them, then you're willing to give them up. You're willing to do that because you will not stoop to the same level as the one who's cheating you by taking you to court. I think that's the idea behind this verse. It's saying if somebody is trying to take, you know, your shirt even, the shirt off your back, then you give them your cloak. You hold on to your possessions so loosely that they're not going to get in the way of doing the right thing. They're not going to force you to go into a revenge situation where you're trying to retaliate and get them back for what they did to you. In other words, be kind and generous even when somebody unjustly cheats you out of your property. So even if they're cheating you, even if you're losing property because of this, he says, don't retaliate. Don't seek revenge. If you're in the wrong, then make a settlement, and might as well make a generous settlement in order to live at peace. But if you're not in the wrong, it doesn't say don't put on a defense, so go ahead, put on a defense. But don't try to get revenge. And guard your heart. Remember, this is about attitude. Guard your heart to keep it from seeking revenge. And leave that to God. Don't hold on to what you own so tightly that it prevents you from making peace. In 1 Corinthians 6, Paul says, the very fact that you have lawsuits among you means that you have been completely defeated already. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be cheated? The person that holds on to their possessions loosely recognizes that those relationships are more important. And so if there's some way to reconcile, some way to do good to that person, to answer their evil with kindness and goodness, then their possessions aren't going to get in the way, and they'll let loose of them. Third example is in verse 41. Let's say someone forces you to go 1 mile. Go with him 2 miles. What's in view here is this Roman custom that a soldier or a government official could make somebody carry their baggage, but by law they were limited to only a single mile. And so then after that mile, they were free to go. Now, I'm sure nobody liked this forced labor when it happened, and they probably resented it just as much as we do when we are forced into something that we don't want to do. And, you know, I can just see some slave saying, well, okay, I'm fine, I'm going to carry this stuff, but, you know, you never know what might happen. It might just accidentally get dirty if I dropped it in the mud or something. You just never know. And Jesus says, when you're forced to do something, don't resent it. Don't try to get even, but instead, be generous. Repay that evil with good. Offer to go another mile. Give him more than he has a right to demand. In other words, be kind and generous even when someone forces you to do something against your will. Now, here's a nice practical example. You might not like it, but, you know, it's an example. How many of you like paying taxes? Is that a good thing? You know, do you resent that? You know, you just hate, is that like, does anybody do it here out of their own free will? I don't. Is anybody here free will pay taxes? Not real likely. You know, we resent it. We don't like paying taxes. And don't you wish that you could find some way to see that the government just can't get a single dime ever more from you? You know, I wonder if Jesus would suggest today that in addition to paying our taxes with gladness, that we also pay the second dollar. You know, that Jesus would say, something that encourages us to not resent that and try to get even with the government over it, but rather to recognize that the government supports all kinds of social programs. They feed and house and educate the poor, and we could resent having to pay for those things. Or we could say, you know, I can do even better than that. I can volunteer to build a home for somebody. I can volunteer to teach somebody English or to teach them to read. I can support an organization that provides baby supplies for unwed mothers. I could do some of those things in addition to paying my taxes, and I could be joyful when I mail that tax payment off and recognize that it's an act of obedience to God and that I'm just doing what the scriptures say I should do. If there's something that you're doing, whether it's paying taxes or whatever, I told you you wouldn't like that one. If there's something that you're having to do because you're forced to do it, then be careful not to find subtle little ways of venting your resentment in order to get revenge. Jesus says, do it gladly, and then on top of that, be generous. The fourth and final example is in verse 42. Give to the one who asks you, and don't turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Now, this is another one of those verses that causes a horrible amount of soul-searching and confusion, because at face value, it seems to be saying that we should give everybody whatever they ask us for. And in fact, I'll make it even more unappealing than that. I think because of the context, that it's probably talking about people who are actually taking advantage of your generosity. And what they deserve is nothing, but Jesus tells us to continue to be generous even though they don't deserve anything, because they're taking advantage of your generosity. And he says, don't try to punish them by cutting them off from help, but be kind, be generous, and even if they mistreat you or manipulate you or lie to you. In other words, be kind and generous even when someone takes advantage of your generosity. Almost every week here at the church, we will have somebody show up that's never been to our church before, and they'll come just off the street looking for money, asking for money. Now, most of them are liars. And one Sunday morning, this guy came by here looking for money because he wanted to get his car fixed. And he said he needed an operation, and the only place that he could get it done was at the VA hospital in Houston, because that's where he was registered. And if we could give him enough money to repair his transmission, then he was going to drive down there. And his surgery was scheduled for tomorrow. And so is there any way that we could help him get down to Houston, get his car fixed so he could drive down there? Now, you know, when I hear a story like that, my heart goes out to a person like that. My heart goes out to him, and I try to imagine what it would be like to be in that situation, just completely lost. And I think about all the things that God has given me and all the things that I enjoy, and I want to do something to help him, except for one small little thing, and that's that I remember that a year ago, this same guy driving the same car with the same problem, the same operation, the exact same story, came to our church on a Sunday morning and hit David Nicholson up for $50 so he can have his operation on Monday morning. And when I hear about that, and I remember that, I said to the guy, you know what? You were here a year ago, and you told us that same story. And you were driving the same car, and you had the same friend with you sitting in the front seat. And the guy just got angry, and he started shouting at me and telling me what a rotten church we were, what a sorry place, that we wouldn't even help somebody that was in need, and then he just zipped away. Now, it's amazing to me how many of the folks who come in looking for money know this verse in Matthew. They have it memorized. I don't know if they have any other verse memorized, but I hear this one a lot, because on the way out they'll say, you know, God says, Jesus says, give to the one who asks you, and you're not doing that. And they're ready to quote that as soon as it becomes obvious that they're not going to get what they asked for. You know, there are a lot of things that bug me, but one of the things that really hacks me off is when people take advantage of grace. When somebody does that, when they answer our generosity with insults and threats, and when they demonstrate absolutely no gratitude for our kindness or the church's money or the time that we spend with them, I'll admit, it really makes me mad. And, you know, if it was just up to me, you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to insult them right back. I'd like to say, well, yeah, and let me tell you something, too, about you, and I'll raise you that, you know? That's what I'd like to do. And that's not what Jesus wants me to do. And that's not what Jesus wants any of us to do. I'd like to just never have them take another minute of time and make sure that they never see a dime of money that people have given to help families that are really in need. That's what I'd like. But Jesus says, don't turn away. Don't try to get even. Don't try to make sure that they get what they deserve. Be kind and be generous. And by the way, this verse doesn't say give people whatever they ask. It says give to the one who asks you. And I think that means we need to exercise discernment in what we give, that we need to ask questions, and we need to use discernment in handling requests for money. But there's no reason that in that process we can't be kind and generous. And even when somebody takes advantage of our generosity, that we still repay that with kindness and patience and generosity. You know what? That is part of the kingdom code. Jesus says, I know that justice is important to you. I know that that's really up there on your list. And I know that it hurts when you've been wronged, but be careful. There's a danger here. Never let your thirst for justice turn into a quest for revenge. Don't get even. Okay, so you've been attacked, you've been cheated, you've been forced to do something, you've been taken advantage of, but answer that evil with kindness and with generosity, and then leave everything else to God, because that's his job, and he does it really well. Let's pray together as we close. Father,